So let me begin by asking if you've heard the one about the architect and the archaeologist. You know those stories? Have you heard the one about the architect and the archaeologist? Well, the good news is I'm not telling a joke after Tommy prayed so wonderfully. I've raised the one about the architect and the archaeologist because I think those two jobs picture the problem and the answer to our preaching. When it comes to approaching a text and approaching a sermon with the Bible in front of us, I mean, Tommy's an architect, so he can tell you. What do architects do? They design stuff, right? What do archaeologists do? Well, they discover stuff if you want to use two D's. I mean, I can't have as many D's as Scott had P's in that whole thing. He even went out for pizza. It was like, what the heck? Plus at Baptist with all those P's. Do Baptists alliterate, or is that Anglicans? I can't remember. So architects design, archaeologists discover. And I think the thing that we need to remember is that as we come to the text of the Bible, we are archaeologists. We are digging to discover. We are looking to discover what's there. We're not designing stuff that isn't there. This is not the time for creative reflection, for imagination. When we come to the Bible, we come with our archaeologist hat on. So I want to address you today as a bunch of archaeologists. We're digging into the text. We're looking to uncover what lies underneath the surface of the text. And the particular instruction that applies to that is, as you know from your sheet, and as Scott has already reminded us, it's the starting point on our road of exegesis. So if the starting point on our pathway for preparation is the text, and by the way, let's not forget that. When we come, we start not with our audience, but with the text. Because if we start with the audience, we're in deep weeds, aren't we? We're going to think of all sorts of things that we should be saying to them today without actually thinking about what is the text saying. As Bible teachers, we are under the authority of the text. In many ways, what we want to do with this Simeon Trust workshop, year in and year out, is to place you under an exquisite burden. To let the text rule you. So whatever you had in your mind when you were thinking about your sermon series, when you get into your study and you open the Bible and you've got your text, that then is in the driving seat, right? And so we're not architects designing and inventing, or we're not inventors. What we are archaeologists who dig and discover. And structure is the first step along that journey. On your prep sheet, the first thing that you were asked to do in preparing your passage for your small groups is what? Answer the question about how the author has organized the text. Structure is an organization word, right? It has to do with parts and how parts fit together. And by the way, that's very important because when we've just identified the parts, we haven't yet got the structure. We've just got the building blocks, right? Structure doesn't have to do just with identifying the parts. Structure is to look at how the different parts have been put together. So imagine you farming in the Free State where I come from, Zastron, right down there in the southeastern Free State near Matatiel on the border of Lesotho. That's why my name is actually Tabu, which is joy, but in Kiswahili, Tabu means trouble, which is probably appropriate, actually. Troubling joy. Imagine you farming and you digging in your on the land and you uncover the mother of all bones. I'm not talking about some little sheep bone or something. I'm talking about a colossal bone. And then you dig and you find another bone and another bone and eventually you think, yo, there's some money to be made here. We get the museum in, the guys come, they put a red tape around the place, they dig. Eventually they've got a whole pile of bones over there. What have we got? We don't know. We've got a pile of bones, building blocks. It's only when the people from the museum come and they put all those bones together and then you see the whole skeleton, then we see the structure. Bricks, concrete, metal, in reinforcement, all of that is just building blocks, but when the building's there, or at least before the cladding is there, you see the steel structure. So the structure is how, not just what are the bits, but how are the bits organized. So when you are asked in your worksheet, how has the author organized the text? It's not just what are the building blocks in the text, but how has the author put those together? Why does that matter? Why does it matter that we discover the structure of the text? How the thing is organized? What does the way the thing is organized show us? Would you say? It shows us the emphasis, which is the other question in your worksheet, right? How has the author organized the text? How has the way in which the author has organized the text, what does it reveal about the emphasis? Now, behind what I've been saying, there's an assumption. There's actually a conviction that underlies what we're saying. We're dealing, as Scott said to us in this session, we're dealing with a tool. We're going to be working on how to discern structure and how to use what we've discerned about structure to see the emphasis. That's the tool we're going to be practicing in a moment. But behind these tools, there is a particular conviction, and I'm going to give it to you. Every text has a structure. Even those texts which we feel are most haphazard, you know, like bits of Ecclesiastes or Proverbs, all of them have a structure. And remember, when we're talking about structure, if we can change now to a building metaphor, imagine someone designing the steel structure of a building. The structure that is there is intentional, right? It's not haphazard. It's not accidental. When God puts together the human body and he takes all those bits of bones and he joins them all into a skeleton, there's purpose. And in that sense, so the author has designed something. The author is the architect, right? He's taken the bits and he's designed the bits. He's put them together in a certain way. We come along to discover. Imagine if we're talking about bones, imagine you're walking. Imagine that you are the guy with the X-ray glasses on. And the text that you're looking at it with X-ray glasses to see the bones, to see the structure inside. You get the picture? We've used a number of illustrations. I hope you see what we're saying. Every text has a structure, and the structure reveals an emphasis. The main thing that the text is about. So the text is about lots of stuff, right? There's lots of stuff going on in the text, especially with Paul in Romans. In any given passage in Romans, there's lots of stuff going on, right? But the question is, what is the main thing that is going on in my passage? Why do we need to discover that emphasis as preachers? Think about the first conviction that Scott gave us. Yeah, we want the emphasis of the text to shape the emphasis of the sermon. This is what happens when we try and have, where we want to have the Bible in the driving seat. Right? We want the Bible in the driving seat in the pulpit. The text is king over the preacher, not the preacher is king over the text. We all have heard sermons where the preacher is, it's the drunk preacher. You're not going to use the drunk preacher, are you, in your illustration? You know the drunk preacher? I make this drawing and then guys think I'm talking about Jay-Z, but I'm not. This is not a shower. There's the drunk preacher. The drunk preacher uses the Bible the way a drunk man uses a lamppost. For support, not for illumination. Yeah? It's that going from text straight to today. I've got something I want to say. I'm going to find the Bible. It's going to make the Bible say what I want to say. The first step in having the Bible in the driving seat is let's see how the author has organized the text. Let's see what the author's emphasis is based on the structure. Not, I think this text is about that, but the evidence that I can see, the bones and the way they're put together, the parts and how they join, the sinews and all the other muscles. How is this put together? That'll give me the shape of the text. That'll give me the author's emphasis. That's what I want to have controlling my sermon. I've still got a lot of work to do on the persuasion, on my argument. But if I haven't grasped the text, its organization, and its emphasis, I'm in trouble. In fact, you could say that the emphasis is the first pass at that main point. On your worksheet, right? Number three, what is the main point that the author is arguing? Remember? The first pass at that main point is the emphasis of the text. Scott's going to help us build around that with context later on. We clear? So as preachers, in one way, we are not architects. Paul is the architect. He's designing Romans. We are, as it were, the archaeologists. We come and we dig in Romans and we uncover the parts. But not for the part's sake, but so that we can see the connections, the shape, how these things fit together. How has the author organized the text? What does the way the author has organized the text reveal about the emphasis of the author? We good? This is not rocket science. You might have heard this before. Certainly if you've come to a workshop before, you've heard this. But brothers, it's a bit like, I don't know, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'm always telling people I'm a Liverpool fan, just at the moment. We've had so much pain over the years. If you're an Arsenal fan, sorry for you. I'm also an Amakosi fan, so there's a bit of humility there for me. So I've got joy and humility side by side at the moment. Why am I telling you all of this? I've got absolutely no idea. Never mind. Just press delete. Okay, so here we are. We're working with this text. This is the problem when you get old and you don't have notes. You can't remember what you're saying. Okay, so we're coming to this text. We're coming to Paul's letters to the Romans. We want to do work on emphasis, and to do work on emphasis, we want to do work on structure. What are the tools that we use for letters when it comes to structure? When it comes to working with structure, what's perhaps the first question we have to ask ourselves? Would you say? And if you've been to a workshop already, you might know this. So feel free to speak up. What's the first question? Okay, let me take one step back. Before we even ask a question, what's the first thing we have to do in this process of discovering structure?
Read.
Pray. Yeah, pray. Thank you. Yes, pray. Lord, give me eyes to see. Read. And how many times? Reread, reread. Read with your eyes open. Good preaching starts with good observation. Good preaching starts with open eyes, looking to see what's there. Right? Of course, we have to listen to the text. But the way we listen at this point is with our eyes. We see. So we read and we reread. Then we have to look at the type of text that we're dealing with. There are three basic types of text. There are lots of genres: Old Testament prophecy, Gospels, wisdom, etc., Old Testament history, all those genres. But in all of those genres, there is one of three text types and sometimes a combination present. What are they? Narrative. Discourse. And poetry. All Bible texts will fall into one of those three categories. Sometimes they're in combination in a book. You've already seen that in Romans, right? Because you'll have pieces of discourse and then you'll have quotes from the Psalms. So you'll have discourse and poetry together. Why does it matter that we have to identify the text type? Simply because different tools are used to discern structure for different text types. So we use one set of tools for narrative, we use another set of tools for discourse, another set of tools for poetry. I like to summarize these in our context rather like this. I mean, narrative, discourse, and poetry sound so highbrow. It's story, speech, and song, right? There are stories, there are speeches, and there are songs. Three S's, Darce. Man, I tell you. Okay. So when it comes to Romans, what do we have predominantly? Not exclusively, but predominantly. Predominantly Romans is this, right? There is some of this. And by the way, one of the most basic tools for discerning structure is to see when we switch from one of these to another. I mean, that's a giveaway, right? Because the Bible indents it for you if it's a poet. Now, it may still be part of the author's argument, but it'll be a different kind of text type. So that in itself will be a great tool, just to see when we switch from story to speech. Sometimes you'll have a bit of story, then a speech in the middle, then a bit of story. Exodus, Deuteronomy have that a lot, right? Narrative and then discourse and narrative and discourse. Here in Romans, it's largely speech and a bit of poetry when the Psalms are being quoted. When it comes to discourse, what are the tools that we use to observe the path? Remember, look at what I'm asking. I'm asking, what are the tools we use to see the parts? Remember, structure is not just about identifying the parts. It's about seeing how the parts fit together. But what are the tools that we can use to identify the parts? As we read and we reread, we look out for repeated words or ideas. By the way, repetition is one that runs pretty much across all narrative, discourse, poetry. It's the one that's common to all. We're dealing with speech or discourse. What's another thing we're looking for or looking at? Yeah, so what I would call link words. And the link words are particularly important in terms of seeing organization, the how the thing is put together. So when you're working with structure, you're asking, what does the text say and how does the text say what it says? Right? Context is a why question. How and why are structure questions. How does it say it? Why does it say it? But link words often give us the sinews and the muscles that join the bones together, right? Yes? Link words, what else are we looking for? Think about discourse, speech. Speech is made up of a lot of, don't say words, yes. But what kind of words in terms of grammar? Verbs, and verbs are either questions, statements, commands. So we're looking at the verbs. Are they questions? Are they statements? Are they commands? So look at verbs, questions. What shall we say then? Has God's word failed? Or what shall we say then? Yeah? Questions. Statements. Having been justified by faith, we have peace with God. Commands. Plenty of those in the New Testament letters, right? So when these things are there, so as you're working through your how does the author organize the text, you've got that little question about strategies. What strategies did you use to discern this structure? I observed these repeated words. I observed these verbs, commands, questions, statements. I saw these link words. Now, Romans is full of words. So can I modulate this little point. It's not just all repeated words, right? It's the words that carry special weight. So this is where reading and rereading. I mean, the word "and" can be repeated gazillions of times, right? So it's not just all repetitions. It's the repetitions that help us discern the structure and the emphasis. So you're going to have a list of repeated words, and then you're going to have to sift through those repetitions to pick the ones that you think help you discern the structure. You with me? The ones that help you see what Paul is saying. Now, the best way for us to do this stuff is to practice. Yep. So let me stop talking and let me get you to talk, and let's work together. Now, I was... Hi, sorry. Yeah, yep.
With the repeated words or ideas, does that include description then? So if he says we're going to be talking about sin and then just describes how we sin, would that all just fit under this like idea?
Yeah, so you've got to, and I think we'll probably have some illustration, I hope. If not, we'll find a way of working. So sometimes some things clarify a main thing. I'll tell you what. Okay, this seems to be your lot in life, right? Just park that. We'll come back to that. But let's work on something, and because I think this example we're going to do now might help us see that. Okay, now I wanted to go to Romans. I was tempted to go to Romans. I nearly went to Romans. I didn't go to Romans. Because why should I spoil your fun in your small groups? That would not be right. So 1 Peter 5:1-5. I think actually let's just, for more, so we'll just go 1 Peter 5:1-4 for the moment. 1 Peter 5:1-4. What I'm doing here is I'm practicing a bit of persuasion. Because one of the elements in persuasion is audience. So I thought that if I'm going to do a structured talk, I may as well get a sneaky little bit in about pastoral ministry because of my audience. So here we go. 1 Peter 5:1-4. Just let someone with a groot stem, big voice, read it for us, please. Here's a preacher's voice for you. Thanks, brother. Okay, what I'd like you to do is to, using the tool of repeated words, key words, as you see them, in those four verses, I want you to find the words, the repeated words, that you think will help you discern the structure. You got what we're looking for? Repeated words in those four verses. Work at your table, the guys around you. Repeated words. Not important words, words that are repeated. And not the word "not." You got them? They're not hard, really. Let's hear. Elders? Okay, let me just get the verses down. So it's elder in 5:1 and elders as well. So we've got elder, elders, and where's the other one? Verse, okay, sorry, it's in 5. So we're all going to have to include 5. Sorry about that. So let me just read 5. Likewise, you are younger, be subject to the elders. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another, for God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. This is why you should never step away from your notes, right? Twice in verse 5. Yeah. You are younger, be subject to the, in verse 5. I'm only seeing one, Marky. What am I missing?
I taught the elders plural, and you as a fellow elder singular.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So elders and elder occurs in verse 1. Yeah, and then in verse 5 it's be subject to the elders. Yep. So whatever else has got to do, it's got to do with elders. I think we're safe there. What's another repeated word that is of significance here? Shepherd. And what do we notice about the word shepherd? Small letter capital. What actually solves the small and the big letter by noting what grammatical features? The first shepherd is what? Is it a noun or is it a verb? It's a verb. So it's a command, shepherd. And the second one is a noun, when the chief shepherd appears. So you must shepherd, verb, because there's a chief shepherd, noun. And that solves the small s and the capital S, right? Because the one's just a verb and the other one is the noun. What else is there? Sorry, where are the shepherds? Let's just see. Verse 2 is the noun, the verb, and verse 4 is the noun. What else is there? Yes, flock, 2 and 3, right? And you would expect that. If you've got shepherds, you'd expect there to be a flock, right? So this is how, what are we already learning? That this passage, just from what we observe, is about how elders relate to the flock. How shepherds shepherd the flock. I'm as simple as that. What else is there?
Glory.
Glory. I've got to say it that way, right? Glory. Okay. And what about glory? Yeah, okay, that's Peter talking about himself. What is it about the glory in verse 1 that's significant? What qualifies the glory? What kind of glory is it? Yeah? Which makes it present or future? It's a future glory. Right? And it's about to be revealed. It's a glory that will be revealed. So it's a revealing, to be revealed, future glory. What about the second glory? What are we talking about there? A crown of glory. Where's that? Verse 4. Verse 4. A crown of glory. And what's the time frame for this crown of glory? It's
future.
Yeah, future. Why? Look at the verb there in verse 4. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive a crown of glory. So there's a glory that will be revealed. Oh, by the way, how will the glory be revealed? Or when will the glory be revealed? When the chief shepherd appears. So as I'm working on this text, I'm starting to make these little joining notes. This is about me shepherding the flock now, in a certain way, we'll see, now, which is shaped by a glory that is to be revealed, and with the prospect of a crown of glory that will be given when the chief shepherd appears. In other words, my ministry now is with a view to the future. So what are we doing? We're looking at the parts, but we're asking ourselves, why are these parts like this? Why do we have these glories bracketing the work? See, the work is bracketed by the glory. Can you see that? The shepherding is bracketed by the glory. The glory of the shepherd, 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 glory. You with me? So these are just observing these repetitions. Now, what are we dealing with in this passage? What verb is there that enables us to understand what the purpose of this passage is? Look with me at verse 1. It's a what? It's an exhortation. It's a plea for something, right? A plea from who? A fellow elder? So, interestingly enough, we've all said Peter the Apostle. Tell me where the name Peter appears in this paragraph. So I'm not being pedantic. I know Peter wrote the letter, and I do believe Peter wrote the letter. But what I want us to do is to grow accustomed to using the language that the text uses. It's a fellow elder. And what is the word that he uses that's not used anywhere else? What is the word that now enters into the equation that we haven't seen? It comes just once. A witness of the sufferings. The chief shepherd is Christ. By the way, if you were to draw connections, the chief shepherd now and at the end is the Christ who's in verse 1, right? So Christ, chief shepherd. I would be drawing a connection line there. So here is an elder who is calling upon elders to shepherd the flock in the light of glory that is to be revealed and a crown of glory that will be given. But as he introduces himself, he introduces the idea of present sufferings, future glory, present sufferings. You see that? What's the striking word that Peter uses to call it? How does he? He's a fellow elder and a what? A witness. And if you would translate that word witness differently, how would you translate it? Martyr. A dying one. A witness of the sufferings of Christ is a sharer of the sufferings of Christ. A martyr with Christ. It took Peter a long time to learn this lesson, right? I must go to the cross. No way, Jesus. You're the Christ. You don't do that. I tell you, the Son of Man must be rejected. Da, da, da. Peter, get behind me. You do not even mind the things of God, but the things of men. Took him a long time. So what have we got here? We've got a word of exhortation to shepherds about how they shepherd the flock, bracketed by the concept and the hope and the prospect of glory, but in the present, shaped by what? Sufferings. Surprise, surprise, because the melodic line of this book is about sufferings and future glory. But that's not a structure talk, so we won't worry about that. But as this book begins, the prophets who prophesied concerning the sufferings of the Messiah and the subsequent glory, this book ends with elders being told about future glory but present suffering. Now, do some work in your group for me. Tell me what cross-carrying ministry therefore looks like. See what I've done? I've called it cross-carrying ministry because it's the witnesses of Christ, the sufferings of Christ, the cross. What does a cross-shaped ministry look like then according to these four verses. Just let's stick to the four verses. Work with your friends. Yes. How do you want me to rephrase the question for you? Do you want to rephrase the question for me, Nick? Yeah. So we've got, let me explain. We've got glory on either side. We've got Peter who introduces himself as an elder and a partaker in the future glory, but he says something about his present. He's a witness of the sufferings. He's a martyr. He's a suffering martyr. And then he gives a clear instruction of how to shepherd, right? And what I'm saying to you is I want you to have a look at what he actually says about how shepherding should be done. And I've made an assumption. I've pulled a fast one on you. I've called it a cross-shaped ministry. And that's because I'm actually giving you the emphasis before we've actually done the work, which is not great, but there you are. It's one of those free bonus things you get when you fill up your car and you get an aero or something as a free gift. Okay? So a better question is, how are they to do ministry, these elders? That's a better question. Thanks, Nick. You can bring your knots in here and untie them. Okay, you got it, eh? It's not really that hard once you're observing carefully. So from a grammatical point of view, in the middle bit, between the shepherds and the elders who must shepherd the flock and the chief shepherd who will appear and the glory to be revealed and the crown of glory, in that little bracketed section, Peter uses a grammatical tool. He uses two words, which he repeats. So there are important repetitions, those knots, but not just the knots, but the buts as well. Okay? Not, but. What do we call these? Technically, these are contrasts. He's contrasting two kinds of ministry. Okay? We ain't done yet. The fun is still to come. Well, so in answer to your question, I want to say there are two ways of shepherding flocks in the church today. One, I don't want to rob myself of my emphasis. So, no, I don't think so. I think, yes, the imperative is shepherd. But it's not just shepherd, right? There are contrasts. He draws three contrasts for us. Yep. So, not but. Let's have them. Not compulsion, because you have to. But willingly. Not greedy for gain, or not for gain, but eagerly. As I'm writing here, and as I'm working through this passage, I am struck by the words that Peter puts together. For gain, but eagerly. That's a word I wouldn't have put there, right? I would have put not for gain, but sacrificially. But he puts eagerly. How strange. The Bible always surprises us. What's the last one? Not lording it over or domineering. Here's a word. But as examples. So this is the pattern of shepherding that he wants for them, right? But now let's think about the whole structure. If I was to ask you to put a word or two words under the left-hand not column, this column, based on the repeated words and ideas that Peter has used in this passage, how would you describe this kind of shepherding? Yeah, use the words that he's using. Glory. Give me a second word. No? Think about the timing element that's in our passage. Now. Glory now. Glory now. Present glory. We're coming perilously close to Luther here. Use the word glory, because this would be the mistake, right? The mistake would say, yeah, these guys, these compulsion guys, these money guys, these domineering guys, these bully guys, they're all about glory now, but we're about suffering. No. What is bracketing? Glory. So we have a ministry of glory, but it's glory then versus glory now. Yeah? Our ministry is a glory then ministry. This ministry is a glory now ministry. So it's this will preach, right? I mean, is it preaching to you? All we've done is structure work. That's all we've done. And we're trying to understand the emphasis that Peter's on about. I'm going to put the word suffering in here. Let's work at the right-hand column. Suffering? My right-hand column, not your right-hand column. I beg your pardon. The glory then is suffering. Now. This other column? None. There's no suffering. There's no cross-shaped ministry there. Domineering, greedy for gain. Where's the suffering?
Adding to the line by saying suffering then.
No, well, you could do that. But that's not what he says, right? It's present suffering. And there is no present suffering on that side. And there is present suffering on that side. This is Luther's genius. That the true theology of ministry is the old theology not of glory but of suffering. Well, how we would amend that is to say it's not of glory, it's of deferred glory and present suffering. And that fits in with Peter's book. The prophets prophesied about the sufferings of Christ and the future glory. Our ministry models the sufferings of Christ and the future glory. It's not that there's no glory, it's just when the glory comes. But now look at what cross-shaped ministry looks like. Because if I was to say to you, Thomas, tell me what a cross-shaped ministry looks like. Now I'm getting words from this text that I wouldn't normally have used. It's the ministry of willing service. It's the ministry of eager work. It's the ministry of exemplifying. See, that's language that this passage gives us into our ministry teaching. Because when we do ministry teaching stuff, we populate the words of the model of ministry with our stock framework ideas. But now comes Peter with fresh words. Be willing. Be eager. Be an example. So if you're going to pick people for the ministry, pick those who desire the work of the overseer. Pick those who are eager for the work, but pick those who are exemplary. Right? If they're not doing it now, exampling it now, what makes you think they'll example it then when you ordain them? Don't pick people who you have to beg and force to do stuff. Don't pick people who are always looking for the edge. And don't pick bullies. How about that? Yeah? You think this is relevant? It's right in the wheelhouse, right? What have we done? We haven't asked yet, what was the first audience situation? Because when we do our context work, We'll get something of it. Well, you're not going to work on this letter, actually, as it happens. But if you do the context work and apply the tools that Scott's going to help us with, you'll then discover a certain setting for this letter, a certain way in which and why Peter puts not just this in, but why he puts it where he puts it. Right? Not just, why is this not chapter 3 or chapter 2 or chapter 4? Scott's going to help us with melodic line. I don't know we need to do another example, right? I think we've seen the point and we've seen the wow, the pop. So let me remind you, what have we done? I hope we've seen the pop. So what have we done? We've actually done something very simple. We've observed in a letter repetitions. We've observed contrasts. We've observed framing. Glory then, but then suffering. We've observed that this is a word to elders about how we shepherd the flock. This is not a word to the flock. Younger men, submit to your elders. That's in 5. So there's the other word, right? And here's the thing. If you practice the ministry of the cross rather than the ministry of glory, then it's a reasonable thing to ask people to submit to your ministry. Right? And God will oppose those who oppose you. But God help you if you run a ministry of glory. People should not submit to you then. So the submission word comes after the pattern. Because why would the congregation submit to a compelled, for gain, domineering pastor? What they should do is fire him. Because the model of Jesus is the model of humility, right? And if we can't lead with humility, why should people follow us with humility? All we've done is structure work. But structure work delivers treasure. When you put on your archaeologist hat, you discover treasure in the text. But it takes work, right? And discipline. Stick to what the text says. Look at how it's put together. We've got 5 minutes for questions. Every text has a structure. Structure reveals emphasis. And the principle, we must discern the structure so that we can discover the emphasis. That's the principle. Let me write it down. I didn't mention that right up front. If I was to do a drawing, I would do a drawing like this for discourse, this kind of thing, this logical argument. We must discern the structure so that, or discover, if you like, we can discern the emphasis. No? We don't preach structure. We don't preach about the Bible. We let the Bible speak. We preach emphasis. First pass at main point. Questions? We've got 5 minutes.